Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This podcast is for Tuesday, March 1st, 2011. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Ramier.
And I'm David Liu.
As usual, we have three stories to chat about, including Wisconsin, which may have an identity confusion problem with Egypt. The FTC appears to be interested in app purchases by children on the iPhone. And finally, the International Music Score Project. So let's get started. This week, website defendwisconsin.org was reportedly being blocked at the Wisconsin State House. People were reporting that it was blocked on the guest wireless portion of the internet access service at the State House. And this sort of comes in a week of protests and stuff, and unfortunately I was out of the country earlier this week, so I haven't quite followed the news as much as I probably should have. But David Liu will help us summarize a little bit about what the protest is about.
So like many states right now, Wisconsin is going through a bit of a budget crisis, and the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Walker, has introduced legislation to, among other things, remove collective bargaining from a lot of the unions for the state, especially in the public sector, so most notably teachers and other public sector workers, notably excluding the police, fire, and emergency workers. And so this has riled a lot of feathers, and all of the members of those unions are not too happy with that. So there's a lot of heated politics going on here, but that's not the politics of it is not what we're really here to discuss.
Thanks, Mr. Liu. That was really good. And I think the most important takeaway from all of that is that there's this big political debate going on in Wisconsin. If you're not familiar with the details, it doesn't so much matter for our purposes today. But there's a series of groups who are, you know, debating out the various sides of the policies that are at issue. And one of them, who happens to be a group of, I think, of that consists of several unions that are upset about this, is this defendwisconsin.org website, or they're affiliated with this website. And in the midst of being involved in the protests at the, as I understand it, at the State House itself, they found out that they were unable to access their own website from the guest wireless network. And apparently, so of course this sparks like a bunch of people will start worrying about free speech issues, First Amendment related issues. Immediately, some of the news reporters, including CNN, asked the Wisconsin State House officials what this was all about. And according to the Department of Administration, and I'm not really sure what they are responsible for, but this is the statement they released, they said that officially they block all new websites shortly after they've been created, until they go through a, quote, software approval program that unblocks them. I have absolutely no idea what that means. It sounds a little bit like there is a whitelist, blacklist type of network access control going on at the State House itself, meaning that as the State House is the access point, and as you try to resolve a particular domain in your web browser or in any other way that you're accessing the internet through their services, you get checked based on the domain, and whether it's on the whitelist or on the blacklist, you know, that tends to be the parsing point for whether you can actually access the site. Now, the really confusing part about this is I don't know how they're determining whether websites are newly created and how that those are distinguished from websites that have been around for all of time or whatever. My best guess is probably that there is some sort of list in terms of whether a site has been attempted to be accessed before. And if it has, in fact, been accessed, then it's on the whitelist. If not, it probably goes into some sort of queue, and maybe then someone has to go through it and approve it for content and stuff, make sure that it's of appropriate content and that there's no malware on the website. I'm totally speculating, but what do you guys think about this? Does that sound like what might be going on, or are there more in-depth types of things that can happen in terms of network access?
Well, just to be clear on the terms we're using here, whitelist refers to creating a list of, quote, white websites, i.e. all websites fall into some sort of spectrum, and if you define what the whitelist is, you're saying you can only go to the lists on this website. You know, so it might be like wisconsin.gov gov or whatever their website happens to be, things that are known to be good and on their approved list. Whereas the opposite approach is a blacklist where you define only the negative points. So you say, you know, name of porn site is blocked and name of, you know, Facebook is blocked. And so generally, you know, if you're hosting public Wi-Fi, most people I would say have blacklists if they're doing any website filtering. There's a few cases that I know of where people use whitelists often, and one of them is, like, you know, for a library terminal, only allowing access to the library's website. You know, that's, I think, an appropriate use of a whitelist. Here, it's really hard to say. Odds are that this was probably a blacklist situation where this particular website was placed on the blacklist for some reason or other, and because there was at least one claim that they had been able to access the website and then were not able to, and then they complained loudly, and then it was revoked. So, I don't know. I'm skeptical to think this is a whitelist scenario.
Interesting. And another report that had surfaced, I can't remember where exactly I read this, but apparently the same Department of Administration said that as soon as they got the report, they were able to, quote-unquote, circumvent the software that was causing the block and make it so that people could access the website from the guest network. Dominic, do you have any initial thoughts on this?
Well, from what it looks like, it's unclear on the details exactly what happened. It looks like they were using the WebSense blocking software. It's a pretty standard corporate, people use it for security for networks. And at some point, someone somewhere on a WebSense system used Block Defend Wisconsin. And because WebSense shares the block list with various websites, and WebSense added Defend Wisconsin to the advocacy group block, then what happened is the Wisconsin State House public Wi-Fi, because it was filtering the results through WebSense and pulling them from the WebSense servers where Defend Wisconsin was in the advocacy group's category, it blocked it there. When it found out that they were blocking it, they manually whitelisted it. And I presume the whitelist blacklist talk that the representative from Wisconsin gave the press is just someone being clueless about what actually is going on.
That could be a pretty likely scenario, knowing how politicians talk about technical things. So I guess we could sort of speculate a little bit as to what legal issues might underlie all of this, if there are any in fact. And of course, the biggest thing that probably pops into most people's minds is, does this violate the First Amendment, and specifically your right to free speech? If your website is being blocked on the guest network at the Wisconsin State House.
I mean, as far as I'm aware, there's no real laws that say you must offer wireless access to, all websites in federal buildings.
Well, you made a good point, and that's, you know, you are not aware of any law that requires a government state house to have access to all websites. And when we think about the First Amendment, there is forms of protected speech, and then there are forms of unprotected speech, and you have to take into consideration the forum or the context in which that expression is being made. Now, normally when we talk about First Amendment issues on the internet, there's generally not a whole lot to say other than the First Amendment almost always does not apply as long as we're talking about private websites and not government websites, because if you can arbitrarily make first of all, the website owner owns the website. It's like stepping onto his property in real life if you were to walk onto his front lawn or something like that, and within the boundaries of his property, he's allowed to make rules that restrict certain things, like your ability to say something and have it be heard by everybody else. If he doesn't want you speaking to him or speaking to other people from his property when you're standing on his front lawn, he has the right to kick you out or ask you not to talk at all. The same sort of applies for most private websites. Now, there is an unusual scenario which might pop up when you're talking about government-owned and maintained websites. And now we haven't even gotten into the network issue yet, but if there is like some sort of web 2.0 like forum that is on a government website and it's been put up there just for the purposes of facilitating public debate and conversation, you might fall into this really unique category where it could sort of be like a quasi-public forum, and not like a traditional one necessarily, but one for the purposes that it was set up for. Network access, though, is much different, I think, and I'm willing to bet that there's some attorney out there who could is clever enough to craft a way to make this into a First Amendment issue. I think it would be tenuous at best, and as Dominic noted, that there it might be the case that the whitelist issue or the blacklist issue, however, you know, it was actually toggled within either of those lists, however the blocking was facilitated, it might have been done by a third party, not even by the government itself. And so maybe the government wasn't actually responsible for doing the blocking or implementing the initial block. This kind of comes down to the nitty-gritty facts. And even so, even if it was sort of this whitelist issue where you have to be approved first before the website is accessible from the guest network, then it seems to be a little bit more arbitrarily applied. So it's not necessarily blocking the website because of the content that it has, just sort of blocking it in general. And that's like kind of my quick take on this. I don't know if Dominic has any other thoughts about First Amendment claims here.
Yeah, I agree with you that they'd be tenuous at best. Like, you don't have a right to a wireless network when you're at the state capitol.
Yeah, and the worst scenarios that, in terms of free speech, tend to be when the government institutes some sort of policy that blocks specific content or certain viewpoints within public-like forums. And so you've got all these hurdles to overcome, and this is sort of the biggest one in my mind, is that just on the basis of what we've heard so far, I mean, who knows, maybe some more facts come out next week that this was all purposefully done and orchestrated by the Wisconsin government, but we don't have that yet. If it's just like an arbitrary network rule that you have in terms of network access, like it's not looking at the content, it's what you might call content neutral or viewpoint neutral. It's not trying to suppress the speech just on the basis of what it says. It sure as hell looks bad, though, you know, from the standpoint of like what the media has done with this week and how they've reported on it in terms of, wow, look at all these protesters. They're really upset about this bill that's being introduced, and look, their website, which has all sorts of information on it related to this cause, is not even accessible from the guest network at the Wisconsin State House. Now, I guess one last point that I would throw out there is that this isn't necessarily unusual that websites would be blocked. I mean, like you said, Dominic, this is a WebSense is a commercial product, and I assume that a lot of businesses and places that have guest network access services would probably implement some sort of filtering technology. You know, places where you might not want inappropriate content or content with malware to get on your network somehow or on a machine that's connected to your network. So, that said, does anyone else have any other thoughts on this?
All set here.
I think it's going to be interesting to see whether this ends up being a, you know, sort of collaborative internet filter problem, or whether this was a odd political move. But either way, it's probably not going to change the situation too much in Wisconsin, because both sides have a lot of other issues that they're trying to deal with besides website access.
Fair enough. Well, we will probably, I mean, if there's any updates, of course, we will give a follow-up either on our website or maybe cover it later on the show, depending what happens. But I guess time will tell in terms of where this story actually goes. Dominic, take us away to our next story.
So our next story concerns Apple and the FTC, which is under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission for two separate issues. First, they're looking at the way that iTunes allows people to purchase apps, and specifically in-app purchases. So if you have an iTunes account, you have to type in your password once, and then for the next 15 minutes, you don't have to type your password in again. And you can buy any app or in-app purchase without having to type in your password again. So what happens is you'll see kids getting their parents to, hey, can I buy this app? Oh, okay. Type in your password, and then they can just, for the next 15 minutes, download a bunch of stuff, sometimes going into the hundreds or even thousands of dollars in purchases in that 15-minute window if they click quickly. So FTC is looking into that. That's the less interesting part. The more interesting part is the FTC is looking into Apple's new in-app subscription rules, which basically say that Apple wants 30% of a cut of every subscription being made from inside an app, and also wants that the app price be equal to the price offered outside. So you can't give people who sign up through your website a better deal than people who sign up through the app, basically. So it's basically Apple's way of saying, if you're selling a subscription through the app, you have to offer the same price that you would offer elsewhere, and you have to give us 30% of the cut. So it's directly eating into profits, as publishers see it.
So, to start off, I guess talking about the first part of the story, this is really interesting. The fact that there are these apps that seem like they're targeted to young individuals, children basically, and that you can buy additional content to interact with the game. And the two that were listed in the article that we were looking at include the Smurf Village app and the Fishies app, and I think those are done by two separate companies. Smurf Village, as you as just as it's named, it has to do with the Smurfs. And apparently, like, and I went on the App Store page to check out the app itself. You can purchase Smurf berries, and it sort of speeds up certain aspects of the game. And I think the most expensive, and there's a bunch of, you buy them in quantity. You can either buy them in a bushel, you can buy them in a bucket or something, and a wheelbarrow, and something
Yeah,
that's a
it's
whole lot more than
$99.
yeah.
$99 for a wagon of Smurf berries, or $19 for a bucket of snowflakes. In-app purchases. In a children's game.
I don't need any more snowflakes where I am. So that's, first of all, that's really expensive for an app. I'm kind of astonished that someone would be willing to spend that much on their in-app experience. And I don't really understand what this is all about, but then again, it's been a while since the Smurfs were popular. Similar issues with the Fishies game, which is I guess, a virtual fish tank that you sort of maintain or something, and you can purchase various objects for the inside of your tank that you're taking care of. And okay, so like in terms of like a takeaway on all of this, I'm actually more interested. I'm more surprised that the FTC isn't looking at the app developers themselves rather than Apple. I know that the functionality of the 15-minute rule comes from Apple and the Apple hardware, but wouldn't it seem to make more sense that the companies do something about this in terms of like how they're the people who are responsible for developing an app that's, basically directed at children. You would think that they would want to build in their own protections to prevent these sorts of things.
Well, I think the controversial bit is the fact that in order to make any purchase in the app, you have to go through Apple. And since you have to go through Apple, they're the ones who are basically being the gatekeepers for the credit card information or however it is that people are paying. As somebody who's bought things online, that's occasionally a good model. I don't want to have to re-enter my password all the time. But I think this is one particular case where that's been getting them in trouble. Now, I think the real question is this really Apple's responsibility to make sure that you have a way to prevent your children from buying things, or whether that's, the parental responsibility? And I'm tempted to say it's not Apple's job. They put in this nice little feature. Maybe they should put in a button to say immediately sign out so that this can't happen and people can't purchase more things. But I'm not really sure that it would fall on the app developers if they're using the in-game purchasing that Apple requires.
There is, in fact, some parental controls which can turn that feature off, or so I've read.
Yeah, the two apps that we mentioned are actually both free apps. So in the way, just to elaborate a little bit more, you type in the password so the kids come and say, "Hey, we found this app, we want to download it, it's free. We need you to type in your password, is that okay?" Parents like, "Okay, I'll take a look at the app, looks good," and downloads it. And then for the next 15 minutes, because they've typed in their password to download this free app, in-app purchases in that pa app are not are enabled without having to type in the password again. So
Unless, of
basically,
course, you do this parental control thing, though.
yes, unless you do the parental control things. But I mean, it seems like there's a breed of apps out there that hope to come across this situation, because like you said, some of the charges for these virtual items are just kind of hilariously huge. Like $99 for a wagon of Smurf berries. Like, who in their right mind would pay $99 for that?
Well, the Smurf
There's
berry market has suffered from a lot of inflation these days, so you can't blame them.
right, but yeah, no. I mean, there's no reason to for that to be there except for as bait for kids.
I mean, it's. I think the whole. I mean, this is separate from the legal issues, but I think the whole market for that kind of thing, in-game content using real-world money, is hilarious. And at the same time, really sad. I mean, just the existence of Farmville and how much money Zynga, the company that makes Farmville, makes off of the, all the in-game purchases there. I mean, you add in some social components and some element of competition, and people will do a lot just so that they can get this small little bit of recognition in some online game. So.
Yeah, so we'll see what the FTC does with this. I'm more of the mind that because Apple already has this control available to switch off that, the 15-minute password feature, that, Apple's kind of already done its part. That functionality is there for a purpose, and I think, as you said, David, it's there to sort of be a convenience. It's not and it's your duty as a parent or the owner of the device to, remember that that's the case, and you can shut that functionality off when you hand your iPhone or iDevice over to a child. I am more interested, though, in the FTC looking into the app developers who I like the pricing schemes, and maybe I just don't understand it. But as we've already said here, like it seems a little absurd, and since they're directed at children, for basically for kids' use, and maybe there's adults out there who like these things too. I don't know, but if kids are going to be the ones who are going to be interacting with these things a lot, and you've got these really expensive things, I have some questions about why is the company, not also doing something to make sure that there aren't erroneous purchases being made, especially when there's been a number of reports, I guess, related to various apps in the App Store. But in the subscriptions thing, that's, I think, a more interesting case, and I think it also like signals that we're getting into this new antitrust era when you're thinking about closed development environments. And I don't know that it's anything that's necessarily new. I think that maybe we're just shifting the way that we think about markets in general, and maybe that these closed in development environments, where if you're a developer, you have to agree to get into, say, all of Apple's development terms before you can actually develop applications that are available in the App Store, and they're, of course, subject to Apple's approval and all sorts of other rules, including things like pricing rules. That you're getting into some not quite a gray area, but it's starting to go from blue to gray in terms of what's okay and what's not okay in the antitrust world. This is sort of an area that isn't well hasn't been there's not a lot of precedent in it in terms of court cases, at least as far as I'm aware. But I have heard from multiple people that the FTC and the DOJ are getting more interested in looking at these closed environments.
Sounds good. I don't think anything will come of it, honestly. I mean, my personal view is that it's Apple's closed environment. If publishers don't like it, no one's forcing them to publish on the platform. And if enough publishers vote with their money, so to speak, then Apple will be forced to change the policy if they want to compete in the marketplace.
And again, it's not a legal point, but I think it's a troubling move for Apple just because, really one of the main draws of the iPhone isn't the iPhone itself, but really all the apps that exist for it. That is one of the main draws is the fact that you can play all these different games and have all this different functionality. And the iPhone seems to be a relatively good platform for that, but and has thrived because of all of these app developers. And so for Apple to sort of turn around and say, you're going to give us 30% and there's nothing you can do about it, that, I don't know, that kind of seems a bit rude to the developers and.
See, here I'm more willing to agree with Dominic, because really it's Apple who had the innovative insight to come up with such a platform that's a hardware device that also has The software layer that loads on top of it that creates this wonderful software environment where you can interact with the phone's hardware in a bunch of different ways. You're interacting with wireless networks in a bunch of different ways. And of course, there's also a development environment that sort of goes along with this, complements it very well. And it's what keeps you on the device. It's not unlike the way that, you know, Gillette thinks about razor cartridges and the way that some printer companies think about ink cartridges. You come back because you are being drawn back into the device in some way, and in this case it's app purchases and the availability of free apps, and then purchase apps that you can purchase for cash. So I don't like have such a problem with Apple. You know, they're the ones who came up with this cool way of thinking about this device, and they did a really good job making it. So, you know, the whole scheme for them is supposed to be their ability to license it for money, and if by part of that they want to take a cut from the developers who continue to make the environment flourish, then so be it. But you know, it would be interesting to see if the FTC and the DOJ start to get more interested and actually start to, you know, do something about some of these things. And how do you define all of these lines? And like I said before, there isn't a whole lot of precedent on this, either from the FTC or the DOJ or from the court system. So it will be interesting to see where that actually goes and if there are any new rules or guidelines that relate to these types of platforms or services or tied hardware and software platforms.
All right, anything else on this story?
All right, so we'll move on to our last story of the podcast, and that is the International Music Score Library Project. So this is a new-ish website at imslp.org. It's analogous to Wikipedia in the sense that it's open source and all user controlled, users are welcome to upload scores for classical music that has been released into the public domain. So all of the older classical music by Beethoven, Schubert, Mozart, and the like have long since passed into public domain, and they are now being posted online on this website. And so this is obviously very interesting to me as the intersection of, you know, this is a website made by somebody who describes himself as a music geek and a computer geek, of which I happen to be both. And so there's some interesting legal questions in the fact that there's this other industry, the music publishing industry, which relies to a great degree on the fact that they sell, you know, all the old classical music as well for profit, and now it's being released online. And while there's no actual legal cases against the website right now, it's been raising some interesting problems. So, I don't know, what do you guys think? Is this a fair use of the internet to make music more accessible, or is there a problem with this publishing scheme?
Well, since the owner of the website is mostly using works that are in the public domain, that actually means that their copyright has expired. And copyright, just like patent protections, expire over after a term or a set period of time. And it varies depending on the nature of the work, the type of the work, and when it was first published. But generally, you have rights, the exclusive rights under the Copyright Act, for the life of the author plus 70 years. There's also some other term expiration periods that apply, and one of the other ones is 120 years from the date of creation or the date of publication if the author isn't known or if it was published anonymously. Since we're mostly dealing with famous classical artists and stuff here, it's a little bit more discernible, and since a lot of that was created, the copyrights have in fact expired. So in terms of U.S. copyright law, there isn't so much a problem, and you don't even have to go into the realm of fair use as long as the copyrights have expired. What's more interesting is that even though a work is in the public domain, you can still take that work in the public domain and then adapt it or reperform it now that the copyright has expired. You just don't have to pay any royalties to the original owner. So, for instance, the Boston Symphony Orchestra can play some of Bach's wonderful music and then make a recording of it and sell that recording. They will have a copyright in the new elements that sort of layer on top of the work itself, but not the actual work that they performed, if that makes sense. There's a copyright in the recording and the performance, but not the the actual music. So one thing that I noticed was interesting about the website is that not only is he posting music scores, but and I shouldn't say he, like it's the owner, it's this is a crowdsourced project, so it's whoever is using the MediaWiki software on his website, people are uploading scores, they're uploading scans from publications and books where they have the sheet music actually published into some sort of, you know, form that was either sold or handed out or whatever. And there are also postings of recordings. What was interesting, though, is that at each link that you went to, if you went to download one of those things, it also had a link to the publisher and if a particular license applied to it. And I noticed that many of the works, if they were recordings and or copies of actual sheet music that had been published in another volume, also were Creative Commons or some other form of open copyright licensing where it's generally okay to copy it, at least in the U.S.
Well, that's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, so that's not to say that this website hasn't run into problems in the past. They had a minor tiff with Universal at one point. Universal Edition, which is a music publisher based in Europe, where I guess some of the scores they that were posted on the website the rights belong to Universal. I'm not sure which ones. I guess Europe has different copyright laws than the U.S. and other countries. So at one point they had to take the website down, and I think the disclaimer that you mentioned about the licenses was added as a result of that. And they, in the New York Times article about this website, they mentioned the fact that the servers for the website are operated out of Canada, where, quote, copyright law is generally looser, and that disclaimer is part of their admission that they don't know the copyright laws for all the countries of the world. So, do you guys happen to know any of the differences between copyright in, say, the U.S. and Canada?
I know they have a different fair use provision, but I'm not sure on the exact specifics.
Yeah, I think that some of the laws look pretty similar in terms of what's protected between the U.S. and Canada, and even that's true in Europe, although there are some European countries which have additional laws, which there are rights that we don't recognize in the U.S. What generally tends to be a little bit different is how those laws are actually applied. So the statutes might look pretty close, but the court cases handle the actual application of law differently in one country or another. There are different term expirations periods. I don't know what they are off the top of my head in Canada.
Yeah, I don't know the exact specifics either. But generally, with more and more international... with more and more international treaties, you're going to see more harmonization, the European phrase, between various copyright provisions.
It's hard to summarize international copyright law quickly. And sadly, it's beyond the scope of this show, too. The truth is that it varies between country to country, and even within, for instance, the EU, you can have individual EU member nations which have different copyright laws. But this is where things really get complicated, because there are a series, and it's a large series, of international trade agreements. So when you put up a website, that's one of the primary considerations you have to think about, is the fact that unless you have access restrictions of some kind in terms of who can access your website from what IP addresses, it's accessible to the entire world or from anywhere in the world as long as there's an internet connection. And if you're interacting with citizens or people in those locations, you're potentially subjecting yourself to those jurisdictions. And the one benefit that the owner of this website has is that if he's hosting his servers in Canada, it's in a different physical location than where he was being accused of violating rights in Europe. It's very difficult for the European authorities, then, if there are authorities involved, or the private litigants even, to gain physical access to the web servers in Canada, because you have all these different layers of international trade agreements at stake. And so sometimes those are procedural limitations, sometimes it's other stuff. And because of that, he might not ever have to comply with what goes on in the EU, but if he ever steps foot in the EU, he might suddenly subject himself immediately to the jurisdiction in the French courts.
Indeed. Any other thoughts on this story?
I think it's a pretty cool project.
I agree. And it was also fun to see that there are a number of places which are licensing classical music under Creative Commons and other types of open copyright licensing schemes, because I've often found that it's difficult sometimes to locate particular recordings that I've been looking for artists or composers. And this looks like a fairly well-ordered way of hosting a lot of different types of information about classical music composers, and the fact that they're now starting to put up recordings and they're doing it legally under these open licensing schemes is awesome. And it's still difficult even on Amazon sometimes to find the composers or the work that you're looking for.
Another place where technology is sort of creeping into this world of classical music, where in the past there has not been a lot of technology. Anything else?
All set here.
All right, unless there's anything else, I'd like to thank you for listening to this edition of the Technically Legal Podcast. As always, I was David Liu.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm still David O'Brien.
Email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org, visit our website at technicallylegal.org, or follow us on Twitter @TechLegal. Thank you all for listening.